Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Adria Breyer, a member of the club's Health and Medicine Forum and the chair of this program. It is my pleasure to extend a special welcome to all new members who are here. We know you'll enjoy your membership, and we do look forward to seeing you often. At this time, please turn off your cell phones and other noise-making devices. Our upcoming programs are on March 4th, Paula Braveman on the Sociology of Health and Disease, David Shank on March 18th, The Genius in All of Us. These are just two of the many upcoming programs, and I invite you to pick up a copy of the new Commonwealth Club publication in the lobby or check our website for a complete listing. You may register for these programs online at www.commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. Questions can be asked by members of the audience using microphones in the audience at the end of the program. We are recording today's program, so please make sure now that all cell phones and portable devices are turned off, and now I'll begin today's program. I will turn the podium over to Dr. Lynn Saputo, a trailblazer in supporting the body's health and wisdom, to introduce today's distinguished speaker.
Thanks, Adria. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you my friend Ephraim Korngold. He's one of the leaders in the world when it comes to education and clinical practice when it comes to Chinese medicine. He's a co-author with his wife, Harriet Beinfield, in a wonderful book that you should all know about called Between Heaven and Earth. It's a guide to Chinese medicine. He's been trained all over the world, from England to China, and is on the faculty of the American College of Traditional Chinese Medicine, and teaches widely throughout the United States and Europe. He's a faculty and founding faculty member of the San Francisco College of Acupuncture and an instructor of the Holistic Healing Studies Program at San Francisco State University. He's a doctor of Oriental Medicine and a fellow of the National Academy of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. He's lectured every place, UCSF, Stanford, Harvard, you name it, he's been there. He has an active clinical practice here in San Francisco called the Chinese Medicine Works, where he works with his wife, Harriet Beinfield. So it's my great pleasure to introduce my friend, Ephraim Korngold.
Thank you, Lynn. Am I too tall now?
I think a little bit.
Oh, somebody gave me the next slide. Welcome. I just want to ask one question before we start. How many of you here have experienced Chinese medicine in one form or another? Almost 100%. So what can I tell you? Well, this first slide is a picture of our clinic in San Francisco. We've been there in Noe Valley now since 1988. And have been practicing Chinese medicine in San Francisco for more than 35 years. And when people walk into our clinic, they, in our waiting area, they see these 100-year-old Chinese herb cabinets from Taiwan. And generally, people report that they feel like they're in a different world when they come into Chinese Medicine Works, which is sort of the point. Chinese medicine is a very powerful method of healing, and one of its, I think, remarkable attributes is the power it has to transform people's consciousness as well as their bodily health. What I want to talk about today really is how Chinese medicine really has been a part of American healthcare since the early days of our nation, since the mid-1800s, so not that long after the American Revolution, when we had the gold rush and we were building the Transcontinental Railroad, among other things. We imported thousands of Chinese immigrants to labor on both those projects. Currently, the healthcare system, or culture in this country is dominated by conventional scientific industrial medicine, something that we're all very aware of now as we're going through the convulsions of attempting to reform that system. Doesn't seem to be progressing too well at the moment. So is there a place for Chinese medicine in our healthcare system? Well, apparently there always has been a place for it, but it's been a well-kept secret for a long time. Right now, what we would call Western medicine or conventional medicine dominates the spectrum of healthcare or medical care in that conventional medicine seeks to treat all ailments in its purview, and one of the challenges that Chinese medicine practitioners or any other non-conventional, non-medical practitioners have is what's called the scope of practice. Now, conventionally trained physicians in the United States have an unlimited scope of practice. A doctor, once licensed, can practice any method of healing or medicine, regardless of where it comes from, as long as it doesn't conflict with the standards of practice of the doctor's organizations and standards. So other therapies like Chinese medicine or chiropractic or naturopathy or homeopathy or herbal medicine have been pushed way to the margins of the healthcare culture and the healthcare marketplace. And this is something that occurred early in this century, in the early 1900s and in the 1930s, actually, when the pharmaceutical industry began to endow medical schools with lots of capital and were able economically and politically to push out the other medical institutions like homeopathic schools, naturopathic schools, herbal schools to the margins. And certainly Chinese medicine is part of that group. There never were schools of Chinese medicine or acupuncture in the United States until very recently, until 35 years ago or so. So right now, and since the 1800s, Chinese medicine has been very much in the shadows offstage in the American healthcare system, but it's been here. For example, as I said, in the mid-1800s, around the time of the gold rush and the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, thousands of Chinese were brought to this country to labor, and of course they brought their medicine with them. And somebody in that epoch, if they were going to go see a Chinese doctor, would go to a place that looked very much like this, very unprepossessing little structure. And one of the famous early Chinese doctors in American history was this man, Ying He, who came during the gold rush to the town of John Day, Oregon, in the mid-1880s, and he became very famous because he was able to treat a lot of illnesses and conditions that the local allopathic physicians were unable to treat. In fact, there's a famous story of an epidemic that swept through the West, if not the whole country, around that time. And what Doc Hay did was he boiled up a huge pot of herb tea and put it out in front of his store and invited all of the residents of the town to come and drink the tea. Nobody in John Day, Oregon died from that epidemic. And people were dying all around in other counties and other parts of the country. But nobody died in John Day, and that included the allopaths, too, who came and drank the medicine. So he became very renowned. And, of course, he as you might expect, he stimulated a lot of envy and competition with the conventional doctors of the day, who tried to run him out on a rail by planting opium in his shop and tried to get him deported on the basis of illegal possession of opium. But it turned out that he was a very good friend of the local judge. And the reason he was a good friend of the local judge was because he had treated the judge's wife for infertility, and she had gotten pregnant. So the judge intervened, and he was never charged or prosecuted. This is a picture of his clinic, which was originally a store, just an import store, and after a few years, it became primarily an herb shop and his apothecary and clinic. Another famous Chinese medicine doctor who came during that period is Dr. Ah Fong, who settled in Boise, Idaho, which also was a bustling mining town at that time. And he became famous for treating venereal disease because that was rampant among miners and laborers at that time. Years ago, Harriet, who's sitting in the front row, my co-author and partner in crime, met a medical anthropologist named Chris Munch, who went to Boise, Idaho, and went to Ah Fong's pharmacy, which was still there, except that it had been shuttered for many years. And they discovered over 500 herbs and herbal formulas and records that had been preserved from that period, one of the most interesting and most complete pharmacies from that era in the United States. The other interesting thing about Ah Fong, is that he may have been the only Chinese doctor to be awarded an MD. When medical degrees were first being awarded and people were being grandfathered in, he, because of his reputation, received an MD. So two very famous Chinese medicine physicians who were a very important part of the healthcare of Americans at a very crucial time in our history when we were building the country. Have any of you ever watched these TV shows Lost or Damages? No? Well, one of the interesting things about those shows is that they go back and forth in time. You know, one show is 6 months later, another one 6 months or 3 years before. So I'm going to be sort of jumping around in time here, and I hope you can follow the bouncing ball. One of the important questions that always comes up when you talk about Chinese medicine in America is there a contradiction? Is there a conflict between conventional, what is called scientific medicine, and Chinese traditional medicine? From the point of view of a mentor of ours, a very renowned scholar named Paul Unschuld, who is probably the world's preeminent scholar on the history not only of Chinese medicine but of Western medicine. He was the head of the Department of Medical History in the University of Munich for many, many years. And he just wrote a book called What is Medicine? And his definition of Western medicine and Chinese medicine is that they both had very parallel histories, parallel developments, and he regards them both as scientific. In fact, his definition of medicine is therapeutics, which is explained by a rational model that is based on so-called laws of nature rather than on say, divinities or spirits or ancestors or magic of one sort or another. So what defines medicine, what separates it from, say, just folk medicine or traditional therapeutics in any culture is the fact that a theoretical model that explains how the body works, how the body gets sick, how the body gets well, and how to intervene to preserve health or to heal illness based on presumed laws of nature is medicine. That's what defines medicine, is a scientific paradigm, a scientific model that explains the body. The body by itself does not explain itself. The body does not reveal to us simply through observation the laws that regulate it. We have to invent that ourselves. And once we invent those laws, and we call that a paradigm or a theory, then we're practicing a scientific approach to healing rather than just an empirical approach. But given that, the science of Chinese medicine and the science of Western medicine are quite different. They have different views, different scientific paradigms, different models of how the body functions and how the body gets sick and how the body can be healed. So Western medicine is based philosophically on a Western philosophical view about nature. Complex systems like the body are understood by examining the simplest parts. This is called an atomistic model or a reductionist model. When you look at the smallest possible details of the structure and function of the organism, then you understand the organism. You put it all back together, and if you understand the genes and the molecules and the atoms, then you understand the whole shebang. So in a simplistic sense, this model, the mechanistic reductive model, sees the body as a biological machine. The brain is likened, and we use these metaphors in our language. The brain is likened to a computer now. The eyes are like a camera. The joints are like levers and gears. The liver is like a chemical factory. You know, we've grown up with these metaphors, and these metaphors come from the model of how we think the world works. That model of nature, as we understand it, is imposed upon the body. The body doesn't tell us that the liver is like a chemical factory. That's something that we invent. That's something that's an interpretation. The Chinese view is very different. It's what we might call an organismic view or a holistic view. This is a quote from a famous Taoist Chinese philosopher. Heaven and earth and I are all one thing. We're not separate. And this picture is a Taoist representation of the body. It's an entirely different image. And it's not that the ancient Chinese doctors were any less smart, any less intelligent than the ancient Western Greek or Roman doctors. They were just as intelligent, and they were looking at the same body, the same organism. How did they come up with these such different views of what the body looks like inside? So this Taoist view is almost portraying the body like a village, like a rural farming community. So we say in our book that the Chinese view is that the body is like a garden, like an ecosystem, and that healing and illness depend on the balance of various influences in that ecosystem, just like they do outside the body, just like they do in a garden. So that a doctor, a physician, becomes not so much a mechanic as an agronomist, as a farmer, a gardener who waters, who makes sure that the soil is enriched with good nutrients, and when all of these influences are in the right balance, then the garden, the body, thrives and doesn't get sick. Or if it gets sick, it recovers itself. So what else differentiates Western medicine and Chinese medicine are the methods of diagnosis. For some reason, many reasons, which I won't go into because they're very complex and have to do with, again, with this history of Chinese culture and Chinese philosophy, anatomy and dissection was never really an important aspect of Chinese healthcare. They believed, the ancient doctors believed, that everything you needed to know about the inside of the body, you could determine by observing the outside of the body. So our main methods of diagnosis in Chinese medicine are through observation, through using the five senses, by looking at the tongue, by looking at the skin, by listening to the sound of a person's breathing, the sound of their voice, looking at how they walk, how their body is shaped, and through feeling the pulse. And, of course, Western doctors feel the pulse, too, but they feel the pulse only in the context of the pulse representing the mechanical action of the heart. So they feel the strength of the pulse, they feel the rate and the rhythm of the pulse, and this is directly related to the functional capacity of the heart. In Chinese medicine, in about the 2nd or 3rd century A.D., there was a very famous book written called the Nanjing, or the Book of Difficult Questions, in which they, way hundreds of years before Vesalius and Harvey, demonstrated that there was a complete circulatory system in the body, the authors of this ancient text also theorized that there was a circulatory system in the body that was completely connected, interconnected, and that by feeling the pulse in one location on the wrist, you could gain information about the entire body, because the blood and the qi, this motive force or formative force in the body that makes us be alive, was traveling together through these circuits, through these vessels, and wherever you put your finger on the vessel, on any vessel, since all the vessels were connected, you would get information from the entire organism. So this is like considered to be the most sophisticated form of diagnosis in Chinese traditional medicine. And that doctor we met earlier on, Dr. Ying He, was famous as a pulse doctor, as he was called. In fact, he was so specialized in pulse diagnosis, he wore gloves all the time because he didn't want to roughen his fingertips, so that when he felt the pulse, his fingertips would be as sensitive as possible. In fact, in ancient times in China, there are many stories about the doctors of the wealthy and the elite and the imperial family were not permitted to examine, for example, the women in the imperial household directly. They were not allowed to look at them. So the woman would give the doctor a doll and, you know, indicate on the doll the surface of the body where the problem was, and the doctor would stick his hand, not even his hand, he would stick a loop of thread, like a silk thread, through the curtain, and the woman would put the thread around, the loop around her wrist, and the doctor would feel the pulsation coming through the thread, like a good fly fisherman, you know, feeling for the fish to bite. And this was considered to be the height of pulse sophistication. Basically, there are two methods of healing in Chinese medicine that we are most familiar with. One is herbal medicine, and the other is acupuncture. And interestingly enough, in the history of Chinese medicine, the exact opposite situation or relationship between pharmacy and clinical practice arose than it did in the West. In China, starting in around the 11th century, the imperial government decided to control herbal medicine, at least for the upper classes. And so it established pharmacies, and they also made prepared medicines, just like we do today, that you could get in a bottle of pills or a bottle of a liquid. And people would come to the pharmacy and they would look at a menu of products and then another menu of conditions, and they would pick from the menu what they needed to heal themselves, to make themselves better. At this time, when this happened, there was a kind of, as you can imagine, tension that was created between the physicians, who wanted to be the ones in charge of prescribing, and the pharmacies. And the way it worked out is that the pharmacies employed the physician. The physician would sit at a table, and this was true up until modern times in Chinatown in San Francisco. If you go into a Chinatown pharmacy, still there, and often there's a doctor sitting at a table. People come in, they sit down, the doctor feels the pulse, he writes out a prescription, and then the patient takes it to the pharmacist, and the pharmacist fills it, and that's how the doctor gets paid. He gets paid according to how many patients he brings to the pharmacy, which is exactly the opposite of the way it is in Europe and the United States. In Europe and the United States, the doctors control who gets to go to the pharmacy, but rather than the other way around. So that's an interesting difference. Chinese herbal medicine is also unique, not necessarily unique, but distinct in the fact that it's what we call a polypharmacy. Very rarely do Chinese physicians now or in the past prescribe herbal remedies that consist of only one ingredient. And this has been true since probably before, 150, 200, 300 BC. This is the way Chinese medicine has been practiced. And this is a picture of an old pharmacy in Los Angeles, Chinatown. Probably around the time, the 1950s, you can tell by looking at the cash register, probably you can see that it's not electronic or electrical, it's just a mechanical one. So we didn't begin to have electronic cash registers until probably the 60s. When I first started practicing acupuncture in San Francisco in 1973, I got patients who were not naive. They were people who had sought out Chinese medicine in Chinatown and had gotten acupuncture, and these were often were people in the military who had been on a ship or been, in the army in some foreign country in Asia and already had been exposed to Chinese medicine. When they came back to San Francisco, they sought out Chinese traditional healers in Chinatown, and these are the kind of places that they would go to and get help. Usually, the herbal doctor was in the front, and if there was an acupuncture doctor, he was in the back, not in public view. And now, of course, we have not just loose herbs and teas that you get in Chinese herb shops, but we have pre-manufactured products from China and thousands of Chinese herbal products that are being manufactured right here in the United States. The second healing modality of Chinese medicine that people are most familiar with, of course, is acupuncture. And the earliest records we have of acupuncture in China date about 150 BC. But based on those records, we know that acupuncture must have been practiced in some form for centuries before that. Now we have these very fine stainless steel needles that we used in the old days. They used probably shards of ceramic or sharp pointed pieces of bamboo or flint. The technology of acupuncture changed as the technology in the culture and the civilization advanced from epoch to epoch. And around the time that the West began to have a relationship with China, the primary metal that was being used for acupuncture were gold and silver, and sometimes other alloys like copper, bronze. And just as today, many of you who see acupuncturists use needles that are inserted through a tube, they used tubes back then too. The needles were thicker and longer, and the tubes were larger, and sometimes they even used a hammer to get the needle, you know, into the skin. And it was not quite as comfortable a process as it is today, but effective nonetheless. So, you know, this is a common picture. I couldn't find this slide, but I really wanted to show it to you. Last year sometime, I was driving down Highway 101 towards the airport. I was looking up at a billboard, and for a moment I didn't know what I was seeing. I couldn't quite make it out, but it was a picture of a Volkswagen, a VW Bug. And the Bug was filled with acupuncture needles. And I thought, wow, this is an example of how this metaphor, this language, has penetrated our common culture. You know, that Volkswagen of America has decided that this is how they're going to sell, you know, the new VW Bug, is fill it full of acupuncture needles. And I think the catchphrase was, you know, tranquility while driving or something like that, you know. It was really a shock. And now let's flash forward a little bit to the early 70s. And many of us first heard about acupuncture and Chinese medicine through James Rustin, a reporter for the New York Times, who happened to be in Beijing at the same time that Richard Nixon was there on a secret visit to reestablish diplomatic relations with the communist Chinese government. While Rustin was there, he developed acute appendicitis and was operated on in a Chinese hospital in Beijing. And after the operation, which was done basically with local anesthesia, not with general anesthesia, he had a lot of post-operative pain in his abdomen, which is a common result of abdominal surgery. And so another doctor was brought in who was an acupuncturist, and he put three needles in James Rustin, one in his arm and two in his legs, and within 20 minutes, all of his pain and discomfort were gone, and they never returned. And so one of the headlines that was reported or that was printed when he submitted this article is, "I've seen the past, and it works." So with this simple event and this reporting on this event, acupuncture exploded into American consciousness. Here's a series of pictures about something that I observed the first time I was in China in 1980. Again, because of James Rustin's story, doctors, American doctors and European doctors began signing up and getting plane tickets to China. They wanted to observe acupuncture, what was being called acupuncture anesthesia, which is really a misnomer. It's really properly called acupuncture analgesia, that surgeries were being done without general anesthetics. How could this be? So I had the opportunity to, and the small group of people that I was with in China in 1980, observed this surgery on a 17-year-old woman with a lung tumor. And she was anesthetized only with local anesthetics and acupuncture. The operation took probably about an hour and a half. And this, the man in the blue cap with his hand on her forehead, he's the anesthesiologist. And he's actually rubbing this point here between the eyebrows, which is called yin tang. And this is one of the main points that acupuncturists use to calm the mind, to relax the body. So he's massaging this point. And there's another acupuncturist to the right, a woman, and she's needling a point on the woman's wrist. And there's another acupuncturist on her foot, needling another point. And together, they're constantly manipulating these needles, you know, for like an hour and a half. Very, very rapid rotations. And there you can see the tumor that was taken out. And this woman's chest was
opened up here, you know, spread apart.
Her chest was spread open. We could watch this from the theater above. And this very large tumor was excised, and then she was closed up, and there she is waving to us at the end of the surgery. Quite astonishing. Well, let me not get ahead of myself. This was so exciting, a phenomenon, that there were doctors who went to China who actually studied this, were taught to do acupuncture analgesia, and came back to the United States hoping to introduce this into American operating rooms. I went to a conference in the early 70s at Stanford, one of the first large acupuncture meetings, in which an anesthesiologist was talking about this, and what he said was that he had tried on many occasions to introduce this into ORs in the U.S. and had met with overwhelming resistance. And he said the resistance came from two fronts. One was doctors were not trained to operate on conscious patients. And two, the operating room staff did not want to have to change their routines. That, in other words, if a person is awake, is conscious, you have to be more careful. You have to be more quiet. You have to be more gentle. You know, all those things affect your routines, and this people just didn't want to do it. It had nothing to do with the efficacy of the method itself. When I went back to China in 1984, I had this very incredible experience. This little boy came into the clinic where I was studying, and he had suffered meningitis when he was 8 months old. And ever since then, it was as if all of his development had stopped. He couldn't feed himself. He couldn't talk. He was not socially interactive. He couldn't stand up, couldn't walk, didn't play. He basically looked like he does right here, very vegetative. And we performed acupuncture on him. He came to our clinic with his mother and his grandmother as kind of a desperate last resort. He'd been to many doctors, both traditional doctors and Western doctors, and everybody had told them that they just had to accept this. This is the way it was going to be for the rest of this child's life. So they brought him finally to acupuncture clinic. And just as in the United States, parents are very wary about bringing small children to acupuncture because they're afraid that it's going to hurt. It's going to make the child unhappy. Well, it turned out that it didn't make him particularly unhappy. He was very accommodating to the acupuncture. And we treated him twice a week for only 5 weeks, so only 10 acupuncture treatments for this boy over a five-week period. And I want you to get a good view of what he looked like here at the beginning And now, what he looked like at the end. It was as if his whole development was started again. Like all the lights had been turned off, and now all the lights had been turned on. And he was doing everything that he hadn't been doing. He was learning to walk and stand up. He was playing. He was smiling and socially interacting. He was feeding himself. He looks like a, you know, like a normal kid. It was a miracle. So this is, again, I've shown these slides to many, many groups, and especially doctors get very excited when I show them something like this, particularly pediatricians and neurologists, because these kinds of problems are pretty much considered to be irreversible and curable. And here we are seeing evidence that these are, in fact, problems that can be helped. One of our early teachers, Miriam Lee, was very famous in San Francisco. She was one of two acupuncturists who was arrested twice by the district attorney, once in Palo Alto and once in San Francisco, for practicing medicine without a license. She was never prosecuted or taken to jail, but on both occasions, DA agents came into the office where she was working, which actually was under the supervision of a Western physician, and confiscated all of her records and told her that she should never put a needle in another person. Miriam Lee and another woman named Barbara Burney, along with scores of thousands of Californians, lobbied for the enfranchisement, the legalization of acupuncture, in the early 70s. So between 1974 and 1976, there was a huge drive in California. This is when Jerry Brown was governor and George Moscone was mayor of San Francisco. And we were able to introduce legislation that legalized the practice of acupuncture. And at that time, in 1976, I and Harriet and my dad, Murray, all became licensed acupuncturists in San Francisco. But this was following on the heels of a few other states that also were beginning to legalize acupuncture. In Nevada, for example, the year before, in 1975, I think, a well-known Chinese doctor from China, who was a very good friend of one of the senators in the Nevada legislature, was invited by his friend to demonstrate acupuncture in front of the Senate. So I think he treated somebody who had a shoulder pain or something like that, and there was, like, you know, immediate relief. And just on the basis of that demonstration, the Nevada legislature passed the acupuncture law. And then the next year in California. Very exciting. These are very exciting times. And since then, the acupuncture profession, or the Chinese medicine profession, really, we say acupuncture, but in most states, the word acupuncture means almost the entire scope of practice of Chinese traditional medicine, which includes herbal medicine and massage and things like Qigong and Tai Chi Chuan. Various organizations, professional and otherwise, were established to set standards for licensure and for education. When we studied acupuncture in the early 70s, there were no acupuncture schools of any sort in the United States. We had to go to Europe to do our initial training. So the first acupuncture school, formal school in the United States, was the New England School, started in 1975. And since then, now there are 53 recognized institutions of Chinese medicine in the country. And there are six in the Bay Area. There's a school in Santa Cruz, one in Monterey, San Jose, San Francisco, one in Berkeley, one in Oakland. So it's very popular. And, of course, San Francisco has always been kind of the center of the Chinese medicine world in the United States. And I don't know if this is still true, but it used to be that San Francisco had the largest population of Chinese people outside of any Asian country. I don't know if that's still the case, but this San Francisco Bay Area is the mecca for Chinese medicine in the United States. So I want to go back to this picture that I showed before, early on, that as we know, conventional medicine, pharmaceutical medicine, allopathic medicine, however you want to term it, is still dominating, monopolizing healthcare. We call it healthcare, but really it's sick care. I think Len Saputo would agree with that. Years ago, I was friends with a physician in San Francisco who, before people were being called holistic or integrative or anything of the sort, was doing alternative medicine with his patients. And we were at a conference together, and we were talking about this problem. This was probably in the late 70s. And during a break, we were talking about this problem of, you know, what's the deal here? We can't get preventive health care to work or to be accepted or to become popular or to be subsidized in any way. And he said, well, you know, bottom line is there's no profit in it. There's no profit in health. So this is the challenge for Chinese medicine, that Chinese medicine has been pushed to the margins of a healthcare system or a health culture in which we are either only allowed, permitted to treat conditions that are considered to not even be conditions by conventional medicine, or those chronic, very debilitating infirmities that Western medicine doesn't know how to treat or has given up on or can't explain, whatever. But in the middle, Western medicine, conventional medicine, has all the marbles. But we're trying. We're doing our utmost to try to break through that monopoly. And now is a good time for this to happen because the system as it is not working. And it's clearly not working, and every day and every week the evidence of its dysfunctionality is becoming more and more evident. Until 1997, believe it or not, acupuncture was considered by the FDA to be an experimental procedure. As a result, acupuncture needles, it was not legal. Even though it was legal to be an acupuncturist, it was not legal technically to use acupuncture needles to do acupuncture unless you were doing it under the aegis of a approved clinical study by an academic institution. Of course, this was never enforced, but the consequence of that is that nobody would ever reimburse for acupuncture. The government, Medi-Cal, Medicare, or insurance companies would not pay for acupuncture treatments because they were defined as experimental procedures. There was a judge in Texas who heard a case, an appeal by, I think, the Texas Medical Association that was lobbying against an Acupuncture Practice Act. They did not want acupuncturists to be legalized in Texas. The decision of the judge was that acupuncture is about as experimental as the Chinese language. So really what's experimental is modern medicine. Now that's an experiment. That's something that hasn't been done for very long. Chinese medicine has been done for 2,000 years on millions and millions of people with good effect. And I'm not against Western medicine. I have a steel hip to prove it. Western scientific, industrial, reductionist, mechanical medicine can do wondrous things, and it should. But just on the basis of that does not necessarily give it the hubris to dominate all of healthcare. Let me just skip ahead here. So this is a challenge now for acupuncturists, for Chinese medicine practitioners, is on the one hand, we want to be accepted. We want to become part of the mainstream. But it looks like in order to do that very often, we have to sacrifice what is the essence of our own healthcare system, our own health medicine. So this is a conflict. How are we going to remain true to the principles of our own medical model, our own paradigm, at the same time that we are seeking to become an integral part of the healthcare culture? So strategic removal of barriers to access to patients will bring patients. So build it and they will come. And this has been shown over and over again with acupuncture schools and programs where clinics, low-cost clinics or free clinics have been set up. People come. People want acupuncture. They want Chinese medicine. It's effective, it's safe, and relatively cheap. And I want to leave you with this. According to the National Coalition on Healthcare, in 2009, Americans spent $2.5 trillion on their health. $2.5 trillion. $34 billion was spent on complementary and alternative medicine. Now, that may seem like a lot, because in 1991, it was reported that Americans spent $15 or $16 billion. So it doubled, but in 15 years. That's not a huge rise. And that $34 billion amounts to, you know, one hundredth of a percent of the total. Not much, but rising. And you got to be careful when you do acupuncture, because your doctor might frown. And if you want to read more about it, there's a really good book. Thank you very much, and I'll take your questions.
We have three more components. Dr. Len Saputo is going to make another comment about our doctor. Then we're going to have questions. And at the very end, you can go back there and he'll sign books for you. We only have a few, so I know there's going to be an overabundance. They will mail it to you within 48 hours.
Ephraim, I couldn't agree with you more. What a wonderful privilege it is to have a master who's also, he doesn't like to be acknowledged, but he deserves to be acknowledged, as does his wife, because they're an inseparable pair who've not only created this book, but they've become legends throughout the world for the work that they do. And it's been done largely selflessly, too, because I can tell you they're not rich people. They've been doing what they can to make healthcare move forward. I've been an internist in medicine since 1965, about 45 years. And I have to tell you, I'm a recovering internist. The stuff that Ephraim is talking about is the essence of what is not present in healthcare reform today. What we need is a system that is sensible, one that is a healthcare system, as you pointed out, and it's absolutely correct. And there is a hierarchy that we should be following, where we start with lifestyle first. And Chinese medicine is a lifestyle. It's not just something that you use when there's a challenge to a particular health issue. If that doesn't work and we don't take care of ourselves, then we move on to other more aggressive things, but it's still not Western medicine. It might be homeopathy or chiropractic or some other herbal approach to medicine outside of Chinese medicine or in Chinese medicine. If that doesn't work, let's get aggressive. Then we can start using things like vitamins and minerals and supplements. And then if that all fails, that's where Western medicine should come in. So I'm totally agreeing with you in this great presentation that gives you the history of Chinese medicine in this country. and gives us some hope that there's a place for it in the future, because there absolutely is a need for integrative collaborative care. So with that, I want to thank him one more time for a masterful presentation. And if you have questions, he'll take them.
The bottom line basically is that the body can heal when you give it the tools and take the gook out of the way. Acupuncture is foundational.
Take the gook out of the way. That's good.
Yeah. We have time for, I'm sorry, two questions. You'll have to ask the doctor questions afterwards. Does anyone on this side of the room, since I happen to be here, have a question?
I have several questions. I'll make them really simple. There is a patch you can put on the bottom of your feet that is bamboo and ginseng and all kinds of things that's supposed to take the toxins out of your body. How do you feel about that and the method of using magnets to subtract the pain out of your body and zinc? Those three things, please.
Well, I'll address the second question first, because it's interesting, I didn't talk about this, but I wanted to. There were a lot of things that I left out of this talk that I wanted to talk about. But part of the history of acupuncture in America is that acupuncture has been done by doctors in America for a long time, on and off. There have been various fads. And one of the famous American doctors was William Osler, and he even wrote a textbook, a very famous textbook that's still a basic textbook for medical students on clinical medicine. And originally he had a whole chapter devoted to acupuncture because he believed, or he had decided, concluded that acupuncture was the best treatment for back pain. And it was something that he learned from a doctor in England. And he had no idea that acupuncture originated in China or knew anything about Chinese medicine. But at the same time that acupuncture, I should say that Westerners were becoming interested in acupuncture and the theories about acupuncture and about qi, about this vital energy, was at the same time that the technology of electricity and magnetism was being discovered and developed. So doctors were using magnet therapy, and they were using electrical therapy starting in the latter part of the 19th century. It was one of those medical, fads that, we experience all the time and keeps coming back. And now, magnet therapy it works. Acupuncture points, whatever they are, and nobody really has been able to explain what they are from a Western perspective. You can stimulate them by many different means. The magnet is one way, electricity is another way, heat, lasers, pressure, needles. You can put herbs on acupuncture points. You can even put prayers on acupuncture points, which the Chinese people and other people in Asia still do.
I would like the listening audience and those here to know that you can find the doctor at www.chinese-medicine-works.com, chinese-medicine-works.com. Our thanks to Dr. Ephraim Korngold for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.